So I chose this passage to speak on today because I think it's one of the most beautiful passages in the Bible. Hearing it always takes me back to a particular moment in Christmas services at First Mennonite Church in Winnipeg when I was growing up, when the sanctuary lights would all be turned off and the space would be lit only by candles. The flame would be passed from one person to another throughout the sanctuary, and as hot wax would drip through down your hands, we would all hold together to the hope of light shining in the darkness. I love that memory, but I've been reflecting on this passage over the last few months, and I think it holds something big, something really fundamental, in one short sentence right there in the middle. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. This passage is remarkable in part because it sets our understanding of Christ in the very beginning, before creation itself. The other Gospels start with sort of human genealogies. They start with his human lineage and where Jesus was born and that sort of thing. But this is back to the creation story. And this is actually the third biblical creation story, right? We've got the first one set in 7 days in Genesis 1. We've got Adam and Eve in the garden in Genesis 2. And then we have the opening lines of the Gospel of John. And like the creation accounts in Genesis, this story sets the foundation, I think, for how we ought to relate to the world around us, to each other, and to God. This story of creation coming in and through Christ doesn't really dwell in our contemporary questions that we might ask about, you know, whether the 7 days in Genesis are literal 24-hour days, or how precisely the story of Adam and Eve kind of fits into that 7-day lineage. But instead, it presents us with something even harder for us to understand, that creation came into being through a man that people had met. And it's this notion of all things that I think really gets at me. Jocelyn doesn't like this part, but you might notice, as I did, that although the opening of John covers a lot of theological territory very fast, this one sentence strikes me as being kind of redundant. It actually says the same thing, or just about the same thing, twice. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. Now, all the kids here will know that if your parents tell you it's time to pick up all the toys on the floor, or that they don't want to see one toy left on the floor when you're done cleaning up, the same work needs to get done. That's not a problem or a criticism from me. Engineers love redundancy. Redundancy is good. We put redundant systems in place where failure has serious consequences. This is not a point we can afford to miss. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. I think to us today, it seems obvious to think of kind of one triune God. We've received this as a completed bit of knowledge. But the early church at the time that especially the Gospel of John was written down was surrounded by people worshiping many different gods. The Romans and the Greeks surrounding the first followers of Christ had these big pantheons of gods that they believed had power over certain limited aspects of life. The sea, the harvest, safe travel, love, and war. There was one specific God for sort of every occasion or concern. But the faith of John's gospel is different. There's one God, the creator of all things, with not one thing excluded. And at the time, it was probably a little controversial to say there was nothing for any of these other gods to do. No space to worship them alongside. And although we live in a different world today, where those ancient gods are found in mythology books and not in temples in our neighborhoods, we still live in a world that most people think of as very divided, as very separated, and very cleanly and clearly split apart. We believe very seriously, life and death seriously, in imaginary lines we call borders. Many people would like to tell you that some people are more deserving of our help, of our friendship, of belonging to our communities, depending on where they were born, the color of their skin, or the amount of money in their bank accounts. But I think this passage refuses and collapses those distinctions. It removes all the distance between us. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. So if all things came into being through Christ, then what ultimate significance can we give to what side of a border someone was born on? I think that if we take universal createdness seriously, we have to see the world in a different way than many people do. That if you, if my neighbor and my enemy have all been called into being in and through Christ, the distances that we see between us are those we have imagined, those we have created, and those we have chosen. I think this testimony to universal createdness also gives us a path to connect to what are sometimes difficult stories to tell. If you've noticed at some point in reading the Bible that a few Old Testament stories are a little difficult, you are not alone. This fall in the youth Sunday school class that Jocelyn and I lead, we'll be working our way through Exodus. which is a story, of course, about God's promise and deliverance, liberation, but that liberation starts in slavery. It comes through plagues and soldiers drowning in the sea. The story that we've now turned into the colorful musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat starts with brothers selling their own brother into slavery. And the first passage we heard today, the story of Cain and Abel, sets one jealous brother against another, leading to the first murder in the Bible. I think we have to acknowledge that these are in many ways horrible stories, and many people struggle with how we ought to tell these stories in the church, especially to children. Sometimes we kind of gloss over the uglier bits to try to tell a nicer story, a friendlier story. We might skip a little quickly over the flood part and get to the rainbow. So I don't want to minimize those challenges, but I think universal createdness gives us another way to approach and appreciate these stories, and I think Christians have been doing this for a long time. I'll give an example here from Gregory of Nyssa, who's one of the bishops in the early church. He's writing from Cappadocia in the 4th century. And this is what he wrote in response to people in his church having purchased slaves. So there will be a couple of words here, obols and staters. Those are ancient Greek coins. You can kind of substitute dollars there. And so this is what he says. "For what price, tell me, what did you find in existence worth as much as this human nature? What price did you put on rationality? How many obols did you reckon the equivalent of the likeness of God? How many staters did you get for selling that being shaped by God? God said, 'Let us make man in our own image and likeness.' If he is in the likeness of God and rules the whole earth and has been granted authority over everything on earth from God, who is his buyer? Tell me, who is his seller? To God alone belongs this power, or rather not even to God himself, for his gracious gifts, it says, are irrevocable. God would not therefore reduce the human race to slavery, since he himself, when we had been enslaved to sin, spontaneously recalled us to freedom. But if God does not enslave what is free, who is he that sets his own power above God's?" So this was written in the 4th century, and it would take much of the Western Christian world centuries to come to view slavery as this inherently and fundamentally wrong. But by starting from the certainty of the createdness of all people, Gregory of Nyssa could see the injustice of slavery in a world that couldn't imagine living and functioning in any other way. And although I know Gregory of Nyssa's question about who would do such things is rhetorical, the story of Joseph provides a terrible answer to a terrible question. Who would dare to set a price on someone created in the image of God? Well, it's Joseph's own brothers who set a price and sell him into slavery. And I think if we take seriously that all of God's creation comes through Christ, if we are one universal human family, then the horrible consequence of that is that all people sold into slavery have been sold by a brother or a sister. About 10 years ago, I went to Vimy Ridge in France. And there's land there that was granted to Canada in perpetuity in commemoration of Canadian soldiers who died in the First World War. There's a huge plot of land there, about 250 acres, which is closed off mostly as a park and memorial. In part because the site is still littered with the remnants of the war. It's full of these tunnels and trenches, craters, unexploded bombs that are still quite dangerous. One of the things that kind of looks very pastoral but is kind of terrifying as a visitor there was that they keep a flock of sheep grazing to keep the grass down. Because the whole lands are still littered with mines. And it's not, the sheep don't set off the mines, don't worry. But the problem is that human gardeners get very curious about bits of metal sticking out of the ground, and they have a tendency to poke around where they ought not to. So more than 11,000 deceased Canadians are memorialized there. And there are tens and tens of thousands of French and British men buried in cemeteries nearby with white crosses that stretch as far as the eye can see. There's also a German cemetery a short distance away, kind of hidden from the highway, where there are, again, tens of thousands of bodies buried, four men to a marker under gray metal crosses. And these battles were fought, by and large, by Christians against other Christians, by Catholics and Anglicans, Lutherans, and I think probably a few Mennonites in the mix there, too. Men who should have been brothers in the body of Christ, but who accepted the world's call to view national allegiance in higher esteem. Like in the passage we heard earlier about Cain and Abel, these brothers went out into the field of Vimy and rose up against each other and struck each other down. When we consider violence in the Old Testament, I think we should bear in mind how God responds to Abel's death. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." I think sometimes we see peace in the New Testament and violence in the Old Testament. We might see Jesus who calls us to peace and sort of an Old Testament God full of anger and violence. But there's no gap between the Christ who calls us to be peacemakers, to love our enemies, and the God who hears the ground itself crying out when a single man is killed. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing, not one person came into being. There are no exceptions here for enemies, for those born on the wrong side of a border, for those who are in need but don't have the right paperwork. If we are one family, the children of God, then we have to admit that at times we are a dysfunctional family. And these are the family stories we tell to warn each other how bad things can get. To guard against the jealousy that leads to anger, to refuse to participate in the cycles of violence and revenge that have trapped those who came before us. Now today we live in a time of great displacement. The UN Refugee Agency reports that right now around the world, more than 68 million people have been forced from their homes. And here in Hamilton, I know rising rents and a shortage in available social housing have contributed to increasing homelessness that we can see around the corner in our own neighborhood. So when God asks us, as he asked Cain, where our brothers and sisters are, the ones that God knows were made in God's image, I hope we're not the ones trying to explain away that we cannot be their keepers. I hope we aren't caught trying to justify, of course, that we would have helped if they'd had their paperwork together, if they had different citizenship, that we couldn't possibly be the keepers of the sisters and brothers who we think of as a little bit different than we are. This creation story, this story that includes all things and leaves out not one thing, tells us about the God we see revealed in Christ, the shepherd who has 100 sheep, but goes searching for the one who is missing. The story tells us about our place in all of creation, that the same Christ who called into being 10,000 species of birds to fill the sky, 30,000 kinds of fish to fill the sea, and 100 billion galaxies to shine at night, this is the one who called you into being. And this story tells us about our relationship to each other, that each of us are created in and through Christ and placed in this big, beautiful, and often dysfunctional family, a family that we are called to relate to through love, whether that's love here within our church family, love for our neighbors, or love for our enemies, love that requires us to engage in keeping, in acting, to care for each and every one of our siblings in the family of God. Not one thing can be left out.